All right, folks, on the phone, it is always a pleasure to welcome this next young man to the program. He writes at The Intercept. He writes at The New Republic. He writes at The American Prospect. He writes at The Nation magazine. He is the author of Chain of Title. I left off like 14 other publications that he writes for simultaneously. David Dayan, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you for calling me a young man.
Well, you know, relatively speaking, we've known each other for a long time, buddy.
That's why I questioned young.
Well,
the use of the word young.
I first met David when I was a substitute teacher for his junior high class. That's not true. All right. All right, let's start with, of the three pieces that you have written in the past 17 hours that I wanted to talk to you about, let's start with the Unfriendly Skies, because it is a sort of a twofold problem that we have with the airline industry in terms, broadly speaking. One is deregulation, and it led to basically monopoly power that has made airlines, air travel, a sort of a nasty experience, but highly profitable for a few individuals, which is, you know, almost like, it's quite a metaphor for the rest of our economy in many respects.
Yeah, I would say it's one problem. So, and you have to sort of go back to how the airline industry came up. And, the airline industry paralleled the growth and development of the railroad industry. The railroad industry was at first completely deregulated, and it led inexorably to monopolization. The railroad owners could gouge customers who wanted to put their goods on railroad trains to get them to market and things like that. And so it was decided that what we need is public utility regulation to ensure that railroads aren't discriminating against passengers, to ensure that there isn't this obscene amount of concentration, and to make sure that this public good is being used to the benefit of citizens rather than to the benefit of a few wealthy owners of railroads.
And when you're talking about when you're talking about travel, the implications of a transportation system on society are, like, seems to me fundamentally different than I don't know, retail, for instance. I mean, right? I mean, it's like
it's vital. It's completely vital. You have to have access to air travel to be a world-class city in America today. Excuse me. There's no other option, really. If you don't have access to air travel, you're not going to be able to attract businesses that do work in the global economy. And so, just like the idea that you needed universal service on the railroads, in the 1930s under FDR, it was decided we need to ensure universal service, a public utility regulation for the airlines. And it was called the Civil Aeronautics Board, and it was put together in 1938. And the idea was that the regulation would guarantee a profit for airlines, but it would say that you had to serve the entire country. In other words, service from Des Moines to Fargo, North Dakota would have to be part of the mix if you wanted a route from New York to Los Angeles, which is more lucrative. So everybody would get service. The entire country would benefit from serving the entire nation. The airlines would be fine because they would be protected. If fuel costs, fixed costs rise, they would be able to raise fares. But if they didn't, they would have to keep those fares low, and the public would benefit as well. And we basically took this away in the 1970s, and it was liberals who All took right. it away.
Let me, before we get to how it went away, I want to just ask you a couple of questions about it. So
sure.
The CAB, or the Civil Aeronautics Board, it guaranteed airlines a 12% profit, you write, on a flight that was only 55% full. So it was, which is, you know, it's significant, right? I mean, because they're half full, you still got to pay for the full, you know, all the operating costs are exactly the same. Half full is 100% full. And so they guaranteed them that 12% profit, I presume, is some type of subsidy, right, at the end of the year?
That was essentially the fares that they could charge.
Okay.
They were allowed, you know, it was heavily regulated. The fare prices were very regulated, and they had to be confirmed by the Civil Aeronautics Board. And the target for those fares was to allow and enable a 12% profit on a 55% full flight.
Okay.
So that was the idea.
And so basically there were caps on what the ticket prices could be, but you were guaranteed, if you're guaranteed that 12% profit, right? That they're allowed
that
to
was, Yeah, that was the target. That was the target. And let's just say that from 1938 to 1978, the 40 years of operation for the Civil Aeronautics Board, there was a tremendous amount of growth in commercial aviation. This did not cripple the industry. You know, regulation was supposed to destroy industries. This was the time of incredible growth within the aviation industry. Now, there were a lot of reasons for that, but it's certainly not the case that regulation destroyed what could have been, this burgeoning industry. And in fact, airline fares under regulation, under the Civil Aeronautics Board, dropped at a faster rate than in the first decade after deregulation, if you adjust for fuel costs. So what I'm trying to make the point there is that the entire impetus for deregulation of the airlines was, this is going to bring costs down. We're not going to, really be strict about these fares. You're going to have all this competition, and the airfares are going to drive down. But in fact, what happened is that airfares were going down before deregulation. So that's a very key point, because that's the entire rationale for deregulation. It didn't happen.
So let's go into how why deregulation happened. I mean, you've explained part of the theory, right? I mean, it's like we're going to, I guess you could look back under those years and say, like, well, there was an absence of an innovation, right? Like, you didn't have satellite TV at that time. I mean, I'm just trying to think of, like I remember air flight and air travel, and it really hasn't changed much, except for it's gotten worse. It's just become more miserable. Like, the airports are more crowded. The flights are, the seats are more crowded. We'll talk more about that as we go on. But so the idea was in 1970, you go through 73, there's an oil embargo. 79, you also have oil shocks. But around that time, the Airline Deregulation Act of 1978 passed unanimously, or almost unanimously, you write. What was the genesis of this?
Well, the genesis really did come from liberals. It came from people like Ralph Nader, who said that the Civil Aeronautics Board was captured by the industry, and it was protecting the industry from competition, which is kind of interesting considering where we are now.
But what was he thinking when he said that? I mean, what was he thinking that it was protecting it from? I mean.
Well, you had these guaranteed profits, right? You had these guaranteed profits in the industry. And the idea was that if you liberated the airline industry from this yoke of regulation, you would have suddenly hundreds of new entrants with new planes that would drop prices severely, and that would force everybody to compete. And through that competition, that would benefit consumers in a significant way. That was the idea of Alfred Kahn, who's really the architect of deregulation. He was a professor at Cornell. Jimmy Carter made him the head of the Civil Aeronautics Board, even though he was out to kill it. And he was really the intellectual ballast for deregulation. And legislatively, the main driver was Ted Kennedy. And Ted Kennedy's staff aide at that time was a guy named Stephen Breyer, who now sits on the Supreme Court. And he really pushed Kennedy to do this, what was seen as a very pro-consumer move to deregulate the airlines to create these price reductions. He was convinced that this would make him sort of a hero to the consumer. There was all this inflation going on in the 1970s. There was malaise. But here we're going to make airfares great again. We're going to make airfares much lower. And, this was going to be a great benefit.
I'm trying to shake off the sort of like my understanding of the airline business in hindsight, and just contemplate, like, didn't it occur to them that like all the airlines are just going to go with the most profitable routes, or they're going to find efficiencies that are going, because all this seems somewhat predictable, but I guess maybe at that time there was just no. There was what? People thought that we would have,
if we'd really
be floating orbs
into,
by now or something, or what?
Right. If you really read into what economists were saying in very neutral sounding language, they were saying that these pricing restrictions that were put in by the Civil Aeronautics Board led to, quote unquote, excessive service for passengers. And airlines were denied, quote unquote, adequate profits. So it wasn't hidden. They were saying the flyers were, passengers were being too comfortable and corporations were not making enough money. And if you deregulate that, then you would reverse that process. And that's exactly what happened. So there was this sort of self-deception going on among liberals who pushed for this. That this would just be a purely pro-consumer move, when it was very well known from if you read any of the sort of white papers on this subject, it was very well known that the idea was that consumers, passengers were getting too much and corporations were getting too little, and this would rectify that. And guess what? It did.
What happened was immediately.
A lot of airlines did go into the space. There was a lot of new entrants, but they almost all went bankrupt within about a decade after these price wars played themselves out. And that led very inevitably, in my view, to this extreme concentration. Today, the top four airlines, Delta, American, United, and Southwest, control 80% of all U.S. routes. If you're talking about a hub like Newark Airport or, Cleveland or Charlotte or Salt Lake City, where one airline controls almost all the routes out of those particular hubs, because that's this new system that we moved to, this hub and spoke system, where you can't get a nonstop to a lot of places. You have to go through the hub. So and predictably, because you had this monopoly power and concentration, the airline experience got much, much worse. There was no need to compete on quality. You could stuff as many people into the plane as possible, because if you have fixed costs, getting more people onto that plane meant more profits. And so you saw seat pitches go shorter and shorter, and more rows in every inch you take away from your seat and the seat in front of you means another row of planes in the back of the plane. So just figure out what's going to happen there. You're just going to get squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. And we see this, sort of at all levels of the airline industry. Now, the airline industry will tell you, well, fees dropped. We did reduce fees. But of course, that neglects all the ancillary fees that you pay now on an airline, the overhead baggage fee and the change fee. And there's an actual boot camp for ancillary fees that executives in the airline industry go to every year to figure out what new ways they can do to gouge their customers. So this has become a very predictable disaster, in my view.
When I go round trip, when I go to Vegas for that lawyer conference, I get the expanded, whatever they call it, the extra comfort seat one way. That's what I do. It's
right.
Like an extra, I don't know, $50 or something. I splurge on my way home because I think I'm going to be exhausted. And the seats are still, it's insane. It's insane.
The extra comfort seat that's $50 more is what the seat used to be 30 years ago. They've just made every other seat worse so that a normal seat looks comfortable by comparison. This is sort of the incredible ingeniousness of the airline industry to sort of nudge people into paying more and more and more so that their base prices look quite low, but their ancillary fees go up and up. It's a billion, multi-billion dollar business now of these extra fees that they add on.
I'm still can't wrap my head around what was the sort of theoretical basis from folks like Ralph Nader that this was going to be helpful in some way. Like, because on some way, right, there is, and I've talked to a lot of folks from the antitrust world as of late, mm-hmm. and there is a strain of that in there that also worries about consolidated power with the government, right? That could theoretically,
right.
And I wonder if that wasn't like sort of a part of that, because it's hard for me to understand.
Yeah.
You know, you can say like that there's regulatory capture. Well, you work on the capture part, not the regulatory part, it seems to me.
Right. That's exactly right. I mean, the 70s really were an age of regulatory capture where that term became very prominent. And Nader's work, while not wrong in many cases, really did lead to that sort of backlash where the regulatory part of it is what got switched around rather than the capture part of it. There was this belief, and it comes out of the Watergate and some of the things that we saw around uses of government power, that government power became synonymous with this thing we had to be skeptical of and wary of. So it was kind of a bad byproduct of the Watergate age in some ways. But what's so interesting about the Airline Deregulation Act of 78 is that in the statute it says, that the government should still guard against unreasonable industry concentration and excessive market domination. The government still had the power through the Justice Department to block airline mergers if they thought that it would create excessive concentration. And, they sort of hemmed and hawed around that. And then really in the last decade, you've seen four major mergers. It was American and U.S. Airways. It was United and Continental. It was Southwest and AirTran, which was another low-cost carrier that was really creating a lot of competition, and you had Delta and Northwest. So you've taken that immediately, just sort of cuts in half the major carriers,
right?
And that all happened in after September 11th, which was a big shock to the system of the airline industry. So government had the ability to prevent this. This wasn't a foregone conclusion necessarily out of deregulation. It was the combination of deregulation and a very lax attitude towards antitrust that has put us in the situation we are in today.
And I would add that migration to that system of hubs also, right, was, I think, unpredicted.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I just recall the last 15, 20 years to be about airlines essentially going into bankruptcy as a way of basically saying, hey, thanks for working for us for 30 years. Remember that pension you thought you had? Bye-bye.
Absolutely.
I mean, this is, I remember when that happened to the United pilots, and it was, I mean, just, I remember taking calls from, maybe it was like 2006, maybe it was, that I remember taking calls from people who were just like, I worked for 30 years. And
it's absolutely true, and thank you for bringing that up, because the effect on workers of this concentration is definitely apparent. They use the bankruptcy process to shed pensions, to shed what they call legacy costs. Across the board, wage cuts of between 30% and 40% for a lot of personnel in the industry. It's not really even a middle class income. The regional airlines that service the majors now, you can have a pilot there that makes $20,000 a year. Do you really want your pilot to be a low-wage worker in that respect? It's really been crushing to the workers who service this industry, who are significant. And, you know, that's just another byproduct of when you concentrate the industry and suddenly there are less companies who are bidding for those services. They're going to do what they can to get out of paying for those services. And the other thing that it brings up is that this is an industry that's dominated by the desires and beliefs of shareholders on Wall Street.
Of course.
And yes. And this has, you know, there was a fairly celebrated case just a few months ago when American Airlines, the CEO, said that he was going to come out and raise salaries for his flight attendants and pilots because they were below the industry average. And Wall Street went nuts. And they didn't just drop American stock. They dropped the stocks of all airlines across the board because American Airlines decided they were going to pay their workers a little better. And the quotes are quite amazing. I mean, the quotes from Wall Street analysts saying, you know, that labor's getting everything. The shareholders are getting the shaft again.
I have the Kevin Crissey quote right in front of me.
Yeah, go ahead.
He says, Kevin Crissey, an analyst from Citi, said, this is frustrating. Labor is being paid first again. Shareholders get the leftovers. It's just
exactly.
Unbelievable. And J.P. Morgan's Jamie Baker said the action establishes a worrying precedent in our view, both for the American and for American and the industry. Like, you're going to start paying the people who work for you? This is dangerous stuff we're heading into. This.
And the reason that they do that is because it worked. Like, you know, there was another case that I mentioned in the piece about JetBlue.
Yep.
And the CEO of JetBlue wanted to equip his airlines, his planes, so that they were actually comfortable, so that you could actually manage to sit in the seat for 3 hours. And he said that we're going to compete on quality. We're going to give people a good ride, and they're going to want to fly on our planes. And Wall Street again went nuts, and they said, you can't do this. You're costing your company money. You're costing us, the shareholders, money. And after a couple years of battle on this, JetBlue backed down. They went back to sort of the industry standard of squeezing the passengers by, you know, making the experience demonstrably worse. So Wall Street has this,
and they got rid of Barger. He stepped down, right?
Got rid of the CEO. Yeah, they forced the CEO.
It was like he was Serpico in some way. Like, honestly, it was like you can't do this, man, because the other airlines are going to follow suit. I mean, so what's the solution to this one? I mean, is there, can you bring back something like CAB, like the Civil Aeronautics Board?
I mean, I think you have to sort of first start by changing the mindset here. The choice is not between regulation and deregulation. the choice is between regulation in the public interest by the elected representatives and regulation by CEOs and investors. That's the choice, because what we have now is regulation by CEOs and Wall Street investors. And when you get that, you get worse service that you're paying through the nose for, where you can be pulled off the plane at a moment's notice if the company deems that that is something that needs to be done. I think you need to reimpose some quality of service standards. There was a very good lawsuit by a consumer organization called Flyers Rights that forced the FAA to step in and put some rules and protections around the incredible shrinking seat that we see. It forced them to do it. The FAA didn't want to do it, and Flyers Rights won this lawsuit to force some reasonable regulation around.
But basically,
that,
because of safety issues, is my understanding, right? They said, like, look, if you keep putting more people in these planes, it's not safe based upon the own.
Yeah, you're
going to
get blood clots out of people. Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, you know, we need to do that. We need more airports. We haven't built a major airport in this country since 1995. That would increase the ability for more passengers, more planes, more capacity. You need to open up slots in existing airlines, in existing airports, so that one company doesn't control all the gates in a particular airport. We need to mandate some sort of reasonable service universally throughout the country so that everyone can share in this public good of air travel. And we need, if that means we need to sort of subsidize the less profitable routes with the more profitable routes, then so be it. I really do think we need to go back to regulation in the public interest rather than in the interest of corporate executives and Wall Street shareholders.
Well, we'll put that on the list.
Exactly.
But that said, I mean, it's a fascinating
history.
And
the last thing I would say here is that this is how the economy works right now, right?
Yes.
I mean, the things that we're seeing in the airline industry are no different than what we see throughout the entire economy over the last 40 years. You're talking about inequality, consolidation in the hands of a few, deregulation, workers getting the shaft, regulation by Wall Street. All of the factors around airlines and the airline industry are present in the rest of our economy. So really the answer is that we need a new paradigm for this American version of capitalism that we have, or else, every other industry is going to suffer the same fate as the airline.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, you know, for me, the through line in stories like this is inevitably that you've got CEOs and board of directors who are paid based upon stock price. And they have they have basically a cottage industry. And so their concerns are, you know, basically the side bet at the table. And it really is, their incentive structure is misaligned with the incentive structure of somebody who wanted to build a long-term sustainable business that would nurture a consumer base and provide for its workers.
Absolutely.
And people can go back and listen to any Bill Lozonic interview that I've done, which covers that. But all right, let's move from that story, because you have a couple. Let's stay within the realm of antitrust, because I noticed on Twitter you're pushing back on this a little bit. All are aware of the AT&T Time Warner merger that has been in the offing for quite some time. Those of us who have very good memories remember Jeff Fuchs, whatever the CEO of Time Warner's name was, saying at some type of probably around about a year ago, right after Donald Trump won the election, saying at some tech interview, I don't know, convention or something, that he was not worried about Donald Trump's threat to the First Amendment, you know, vis-a-vis attacks on CNN. He was really worried about the Democrats and their push for repeal of Citizens United, and thereby signaling that he understood what was going to be happening under the Trump administration. You've got to kiss this guy's ass. He didn't have his own forbidden city to take him to convince Donald Trump that he should just give him the store. But the story that AT&T is pushing right now is that Donald Trump is forcing AT&T to sell CNN because he doesn't like CNN and he's trying to punish them. But in fact, the real story is far more complicated and has to do with media concentration.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm going to have a larger piece at this at The Nation maybe later today or tomorrow. But
of course.
Yes. First of all, it's not at all clear and probably untrue that the Justice Department asked AT&T to sell CNN in isolation. That's not what other outlets have reported. In fact, they've reported that they gave AT&T a choice. You can sell Turner Broadcasting, which is bundled CNN with TNT and TBS and I think about 20 different channels.
Yep.
You can sell that to divest, or you can sell DirecTV, which AT&T owns, which is a distributor of satellite television program. So, you know, these two are these are two different things. So under one option, AT&T gets to keep CNN. So I don't understand the...
So you can either own the content or the distribution network. You cannot own both because then you've created a closed system.
That's correct. And that's what they're saying. And, you know, this came up in the Comcast NBC deal.
Yes.
Right? The idea was if Comcast owned NBC, then it could favor NBC programming on its own network or increase the price of licensing NBC programming for somebody else's distribution network. And that's the fear here, too. Now, how did they solve the Comcast problem? Well, Comcast promised to some what they call behavioral remedies, where they promised that they would not, you know, favor their own content. It turned out it was impossible to monitor that. The FCC wasn't able to monitor it. The DOJ wasn't able to monitor it. And what we know from the new guy at the Department of Justice's antitrust division, Makan Delrahim, who was confirmed a couple months ago, he said, well, these behavioral remedies, they don't work. We have no ability to figure them out. So then the only other step, unless the Justice Department is going to cancel the deal and say you can't do it, which, you know, I would say they should. But short of that, the only remedy is divestiture, saying, okay, if we can't track whether you're or not you are favoring your own content and hurting your rivals, then we're going to say you can't own both. And there's really ample precedent for this. In fact, there was a forced divestiture of this type when Time Warner bought Turner Broadcasting,
right,
in 1996. There's plenty of precedent for this. And I think that the media, because there's this assumption that Donald Trump is doing everything, you know, because of his own ego, which most of the time is correct, that automatically this is another example of him punishing his enemies by trying this divestiture of CNN. I really think that goes way ahead of the evidence here. Indeed, it would be a good idea to force this divestiture, regardless of where Trump's going to go with it. Now, the problem is that Trump has pretty much expressed his loathing of CNN, has said that he would, you know, block this merger while on the campaign trail. And so there's an appearance of impropriety such that if AT&T, who is leaking this idea to the press, if they decide to fight this in court, clearly their legal strategy will be, we are being punished because of a vendetta by Donald Trump.
Right.
And a federal court may accept that as correct. And so this is actually a, sort of a tragedy, I think, this story, because here we have the Justice Department finally going further in terms of trying to prevent media consolidation. But because they have a loudmouth in the White House, they may be blocked from actually doing this thing that would be salutary.
It also occurs to me, what happens when Donald Trump realizes that we have a functional Justice Department? Will he not be like, wait, what?
Right.
That's not what we're supposed to be doing. I mean, when Steve Bannon hears about this, isn't he going to be like, wow, who didn't fire those guys yet?
Also, it's not clear to me that selling CNN along with Turner Broadcasting to a willing purchaser would hurt CNN. Why would that hurt CNN?
I mean, Sinclair Media goes and buys it, what's the problem? I mean, that's the, you know.
Well, that would be a larger problem.
Right,
but,
exactly.
But it wouldn't affect the bottom line of CNN. Like, CNN would thrive. I just don't see the rationale here that this is somehow indicative of vindictiveness on the part of Donald Trump.
I mean, it may be a function of that as well, but it's still good policy, it seems to me. I mean, this concentration is crazy. All right, well, let's just talk about one other coincidence that we have. It turns out Wilbur Ross, he was caught up in the Paradise Papers dump. I don't know if I would call it a dump necessarily, revelations maybe.
Right.
And Ross, there, people have made issue of the fact that he has extensive business ties with Putin's family. And then there's other stories that he's been lying about his money because he wants to be on the Forbes 500 list or something like that, which is also sort of just insane. But it also seems that while he's been Commerce Secretary, he's been slightly taking advantage of the fact that he's Commerce Secretary and basically wheeling and dealing with just about every part of the Commerce Secretary's portfolio. Would cover, right? I mean, have I got that right?
Well, so at the beginning, in his ethics agreement, Wilbur Ross says, I am divesting myself of all these interests, but I'm not going to divest myself of this one area. It was actually two areas, but one is around mortgage lending, which really isn't Commerce Department's purview. But the other one, he said, is I'm going to keep these investments in transoceanic shipping companies. Now, the Commerce Department is, and particularly in this administration, is concerned with issues of global trade, which involves putting items on a ship and taking them across an ocean. Some would say transoceanic shipping. The Commerce Department logo has a ship on it.
Is it one of Wilbur Ross's? Did he switch it out?
It's his yet. I don't think they've actually gotten the logo guy to make that change.
But we're waiting for the flag to come back, for the Commerce Secretary flag that will signify he's in the building.
Right. So it was ridiculous from the beginning. Why would you let the Commerce Secretary still hold these investments in shipping? And indeed, one of the first actions of Wilbur Ross is he negotiated this deal to expand exports of liquefied natural gas to China, which is a huge untapped market for LNG. Now, it turns out one of the companies that he has an investment in, Navigator, has a huge fleet of ships that transport natural gas. So, I mean, the idea that he was allowed to do this to begin with is just ridiculous. It's a walking conflict of interest. And what I learned in my report is that the ethics officer who signed off on this, who said, yes, you can keep owning investments in shipping companies, even though you're running the Commerce Department. This guy was an alternate ethics official within the Commerce Department who, within the last 2 months, Wilbur Ross promoted, like, himself. It's his job to choose his own ethics officer. So that
you've
really
got my kind of ethics.
Exactly.
Oh,
a complete failure of the ethics process.
All right. Well, to be fair, let's put the logo back up there. All right. So Wilbur Ross owns a shipping company that he just okayed, but there's also an eagle and a lighthouse on the seal.
Yeah, the lighthouse is watching for the ship.
All right, fair enough. But does he own eagles?
So it's really two out of three of the iconography on the Commerce Department logo having to do with transnational shipping.
Wow. Well, I mean, one would, it seems like that would be an ethics violation, except for what they've done, it appears, is to just redefine what ethics mean, essentially, by hiring the guy in charge of ethics.
Right. And this is sort of a larger failure of just the entire structure of it. If you can have the head of the department choose his or her own ethics official, then that's just sort of an invitation to this kind of abuse.
Is there an IG, like an internal investigator associated with Commerce?
Well, yeah, there's an inspector general, and Senator Richard Blumenthal has called for an inspector general investigation of this whole business.
Does Wilbur Ross get to appoint his kid that or something like that? Like Wilbur Ross Jr., our inspector general?
Yeah. Yeah, I think the inspector general is named Rilbur Wass, interestingly enough.
There is that.
And it turned out, by the way, that American Public Media added to this by saying it's not just Navigator, which was the shipping company profiled in the Paradise Papers, but Wilbur Ross owns a stake in 75 different shipping vessels across multiple companies, many of which transport the types of goods that will be benefited by the opening of LNG exports to China.
Who better to run the Commerce Department? Who better? He knows it. He knows it.
That makes him smart.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's not dumb. I mean, if you have the ability to do that stuff, I mean, I guess that's what they call business, right? Makes it much easier. Well, David Dayan, as always, learned so much in what you're writing and talking to you about it. I can't thank you enough for coming on.
All right. Thank you.
We'll link to those pieces and, of course, to your secret site, which I'm sorry, I'm going to tell people about it. It is David Dayan's Tumblr, daviddayan.tumblr.com. And if you go there, do you have a sign up for your email blast?
I'm not sure if it's right there, but you just go to tinyletter.com/DavidDayan and you can sign up to the newsletter, where I link to all the stories I put out and then give you a little bit extra. I send that out twice a week, and that's another good way to keep up.
All right, there you go. David, thank you so much. I appreciate it, buddy.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.